Namaste, and welcome everyone to Vidurvach podcast. In this episode, our topic is in relation to geopolitics, which is a world in a flux. Today, we are witnessing the dance of AI, that is America and India, in the global arena. A Russian roulette, too, has just concluded. And meanwhile, the Chinese are waiting to outfox Indians again, and Pakistan again witnessed a coup of sorts. So, to discuss these issues and other host of issues, today we have with us our two eminent guests, Ms. Himja Parikh and Mr. Navroop Singh. Ms. Himja Parikh is the co-author of two books, The New Global Order and The Korean Peninsula. She is also one of the youngest recipients of the Global Rotary Professional Exchange Program with the United States of America. And she is an eternal student of history and holds a master's in finance and is currently engaged in a non-profit sector. And with regard to Mr. Navroop Singh, he does not need introduction. He has also co-authored the above two books and is an attorney practicing IP-related laws with the Delhi High Court and Supreme Court of India. He is also a keen student of geopolitics and have written countless and provided his views on the same through his articles, through blogs, and through his Twitter accounts. Welcome both of you on our small channel. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Okay, to begin with our first point, the American-Indian dance. You know, PM Modi went on a 3-4 day trip to USA, and the kind of reception he received there from the American establishment was quite unprecedented, and it has been like exceptional to any of Indian PMs receiving, this kind of accolades from the Western world. So my question now is to, ma'am, that can you touch upon as to, why this visit was historical, and can we say that it is a turning point of sorts in the Indian-American relationship?
Sure. So, what we're actually seeing play out now, the historic visit, and yes, the visit was completely historic, but in 2016, we wrote our first book, for which we started researching maybe a couple of years ago. And back then, we could see that this was a long time coming. It was expected, but of course, things have, in foreign policy, very huge shift, they tend to take their own time. And we are finally now seeing, the culmination of it. But yes, I mean, Narendra Modi's state visit has been historic because he's been one of the few prime ministers who had the honor of having a state visit and addressing the American Congress twice. I think this honor has been given previously to only Mr. Winston Churchill and Prime Minister Netanyahu. So when we talk about why this happened, in foreign policy, there is a basic belief that a country can be an economic powerhouse, for which, there are many such countries globally, but that doesn't make them a superpower. When do you become a superpower? When do you become a country that is significant? That only happens when you have your own military-industrial complex. This has been the key. So India, so far, has always been dependent on weapon imports. It has been historically one of the largest weapon-importing countries, right? So for a country to be prominent, it needs to be able to manage its own defense, which means its own military industrial complex. So India and USA have been doing this partnership dance for a while, but so far it has mainly been economic. This visit has been path-breaking because the first time the Indo-US partnership has converted into a defense partnership, which is mainly the biggest highlight of this visit. What is even more notable is that the US has agreed to transfer fighter engine technology a technology deal, which is unprecedented. It's a first of its kind post-World War II. And more importantly, because India is not a NATO ally. So that makes it, it makes it interesting. It makes it very, very significant. Now, when we talk about why as observers or pursuers of foreign policy, why we find this interesting. So let's sort of take a little trip down memory lane where we can talk about the historical context. So basically, when India became independent, the Cold War had just about begun, right? What was the condition for India's independence? So, well, in 1941, I mean, India became independent much later, but in 1941, when Prime Minister Churchill had reached out to President Roosevelt asking for assistance for, during World War II, one of the conditions was that Britain would have to give up its empire, which basically meant giving up its colonial rule over, so many, of which India was only one, though probably one of the most significant colonies. Okay.
Right.
So now countries obviously ally because they see some, some synergy. It's always transactional. I mean, there is no love, there is no romance. This is basically, it's transactional. And how does it work? Of course, two countries are working together because they see some benefit for each other. Now, where does it get interesting? It's about saying, how can I get what is best for me? Because each country is going to be trying to get the better deal for themselves. That is understood. And that is where, how well you play your cards, etc., is going to matter, which is why we say that there's no room for emotions in foreign policy, right? It's just pure calculations and strategic interest. So when India won independence, the Cold War had just begun, and India was following the policy of NAM. We know this because of, Prime Minister Nehru. So this basically meant that Indo-US ties were frosty because, the US had nothing to gain from us because we were following, a non-aligned policy. So, and going forward, we saw that in 1961, when PM Nehru actually went, I believe President Kennedy was, he was president then, and it was characterized as one of the worst state visits of the Kennedy administration. It's because, the Cold War was, it had gathered significant steam, and Prime Minister Nehru, who was the architect, one of the architects of NAM, was very busy preaching about NAM and why NAM was important and how, any other policy was very, very imperial. So no one likes, no country, let alone one that is, a significant power, is going to like being preached to. So naturally, the visit was a disaster and nothing much happened from it. But then came 1962. 1962, we had the Indochina War. Things got very, very hot. And, there was a point where things were quite likely to get out of hand. And at that point, obviously, the non-aligned policy did not help us. Prime Minister Nehru had written to President Kennedy. He pleaded. There were three letters. Three letters were written pleading for assistance. And America did return the favor. They helped. A lot of other things happened. I believe they even sent the Pacific Fleet. And resultantly, there was a face saver. But of course, I think, the scars, the wounds of 1962 remain. But subsequently, President Kennedy was assassinated. Prime Minister Nehru passed away. So, this is that first point where we can actually go, what if? What if President Kennedy was not assassinated? Who knows what could have happened? And the reason we also adopted, the reason India did not get too much benefit of the Industrial Revolution is because we adopted a NAM policy. And in an economic context, one thing we can definitely see is that countries that have gone on to become economic powerhouses have only been able to do that with Western integration or with Western influence. So, for example, even Japan, like post-World War II, it was forced to adopt a pacifist mindset. So did it develop, its military-industrial complex? No, it didn't do that. But did it become an economic powerhouse? Oh, yes, most certainly. So, when you look at Japan, you look at Korea, you look at Singapore, so many countries in Asia, even China for that matter. But anyway, we'll come to China later. So anyway, now coming back, we were at the Indochina War. That means we were at 62. And then in 1970, of course, Prime Minister Gandhi signed the defense treaty with the Soviet Union. And 1971 was the Bangladesh Liberation War. And that kind of created a situation with Russia where we were literally, for all purposes, joined at the hip. And so the Soviet influence in our country became very, very strong. And I think at the same time, in terms of foreign policy context, the famous Kissinger-Nixon era happened, and the Kissinger-Mao meeting happened. And America very clearly made its choice, which was China. And after that, China sort of, you know, gained the advantage of an economic boom, which of course happened a little later, but, you know, the thaw happened with China. And after that, China was, you know, and has been on a growth trajectory for decades. Now, in 1991, that was the third, because two things happened in 91. India opened up economic policy reform. Also, what happened was the USSR fell. So both the events kind of, you know, they took place together. And because of this, you know, India's integration with American and Western economy, it grew. It started creating wealth, job opportunities. Suddenly there was, you know, there was a vibrant middle class. There was a backward IT boom. And, you know, India was a lot more confident country. I mean, just a few years ago, we were in a very, very bad situation where we had to think about what to do with our gold reserves, right? I mean, we all know that. But then from that, we went to a stage where we started becoming a lot more confident. I think that confidence also resulted in Prime Minister Vajpayee carrying out our nuclear test, because India was a lot more confident. Its citizens were a lot more confident. And after that, of course, because of the nuclear test, we faced sanctions. So things kind of stopped there. They didn't, you know, they didn't go forward beyond that. And then finally, during Dr. Manmohan Singh, India signed the nuclear deal with America, basically, and we got that NSG waiver. So that was the first time we got that, you know, that entry, I think one can say. So ideally, at this point, things should have started taking off. This was the time when we actually signed the nuclear deal and we got the NSG waiver and so on and so forth. But again, this was the time of 2008. So 2008, what was going on? 2008 is when America had the financial crisis. That was one side. The other side, it was also invested in all the wars in the entire MENA region, the results of which we are seeing today in Europe. And so, you know, so things went on for some time. And by 2012, the China that had gained significantly at our expense had become too big to be ignored. And I think that's when the US realized that, okay, we will have to start creating a balancer, because this is typically how American foreign policy always works. They always like to create another pole, which basically becomes their consuming market, the consumer market. And then when they realize, okay, this market is becoming too big, or this country might become too powerful, because by that time, America was the only standing superpower, because there was no USSR post 91. So that's when they said, okay, now we need to create a balancer for this country that we have helped grow. And hence, Obama and Clinton launched the 2012 Pivot to Asia, which basically made India, you know, the cornerstone. Because which other country was there to technically even be in some sort of a position? Even today, we are nowhere in a position. But if you were to think, which other country is there that can possibly even rise to the challenge, that can rise to the occasion? And then so that was 2012. 2014 is when the Modi government came in. And we have seen collaboration, you know, it has grown leaps and bounds. And now it has, you know, culminated into a defense partnership. So like I said, you know, that this has happened now, but we've been seeing this since 2016. And today, you know, as Prime Minister Modi said, AI, America, India, or AI, artificial intelligence, because we are also in the era of the fourth industrial revolution, which means that the AI partnership will remain one of the most pivotal partnerships of Cold War version 2 and a shaper of things to come. And honestly, for us, I mean, we know that USA wants us to be a balancer. But for us, we also don't really have a choice. As you know, we can't wish away geography. We can't change geography. We can't change an aggressive China on our borders. We know that if we were to counter this, if we have to maintain our security, our interests, we are going to need help. So, you know, it's a good time. Both the countries need each other. So it's nice. I mean, it's a transactional visit. And I think on this basis, we can expect many more significant pacts, collaborations to come further. This is according to me, it's just the beginning.
Right. I totally agree with your analysis, ma'am. I mean, when it comes to China, when it comes to kind of, you know, making a fulcrum against China, India is best placed, I guess, due to our size, due to our population. You know, it certainly matches the Chinese one. So, you know, to go more deep into this question, you know, let me ask Navroop, sir. So, you know, like, as the ma'am said, we have signed lots of defense deals. There are tech deals are also signed, and some space deals are also signed. So can you go about as to, you know, what they were, and the details of it, the importance which it has got to us, and also will it have any effect on Make in India initiative of this government?
Okay. See, first of all, we need to understand that, DTTI agreement, that was a transfer and defense transfer and technology kind of agreement. This was first proposed by US during the UPA regime. And A.K. Antony, as a defense minister, had rejected it. And we had that fiasco of Devyani Khobra Gare and all that tamasha that went on in Delhi. We remember that. And so it was only when Narendra Modi came to power that the reset with the US actually began. So like as my friend Himja said, you know, like we had gone through a phase of cold, frosty relationships, to a transactional relationship in the 90s, to signing of the nuclear deal. But to take it to the next level, it was the Prime Minister Modi, because for the first time, he invited a US president on the Republic Day ceremony in India. President Obama was invited in 2015. And that is exactly when India signed the DTTI, that was the US-India Defense Relationship Partnership, right? Then after years of long relationship, India ultimately signed up with LIMOA. That happened in August 2016. Now, LIMOA is nothing but a logistical pact by which India's armed forces, you know, get to share their naval bases, their logistical facilities, refueling, everything with the American armed forces. And we, you know, it's like vice versa. Our ships go to Diego Garcia, their Bahrain base. They can come to Bay of Bengal and Indian Ocean and get their ships refueled, serviced, repaired, whatever they want, right? Then, In the interlude, Doklam happened. And in Doklam, what happened was that America was able to provide encrypted communication of the Chinese PLA on the Tibetan Plateau. And that made India signed up CONCASA in September of 2018, which basically goes to show that, you know, we were sharing now encrypted technology. We were integrating with, you know, like both the countries could share encrypted communication with each other, which are not decodable by the enemy country. And we can also have we had in Doklam, you know, like they could decrypt what was going on. So then in November 2019, we signed ISA, which was Industrial Secret Pact or Agreement. This was for the IPR for critical technology. That was basically America's insistence that, you know, you assure that whatever technology now we'll share with you, the IPR are not violated and they're not handed over to a third country or a third platform, right? The fourth one which we signed was BECA. That was about geospatial data. It was signed in October 2020. So that was about, you know, that satellite sharing, geospatial data about locations and everything. So these were the four foundational military pacts which the Narendra Modi government signed during its almost 5 years from 2015 to 2020. However, so this was this was first the solid base building upon the nuclear deal which we had signed in 2000. So then after I said, the roadmap for US-India defense industrial cooperation was signed in 5th of June 2023. Now, in that, a very critical, you know, terms were agreed to, that they were, you know, US will make India a logistic hub for US and other partners in Indo-Pacific region and support the creation of logistical repair, maintenance of infrastructure, aircraft, and ships. The US will support Indian defense industry, integration of Indian defense industry and aerospace industry into global supply chains of US defense and aerospace industry. India will endeavor to implement the ISA to facilitate deeper bilateral cooperation of classified projects. Both sides will endeavor in supplies agreement and reciprocal defense procurement agreement at the earliest. Projects under this framework will focus on intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, undersea domain awareness, air combat and support, including aero engine, munition systems, and mobility. Also, we also ended up, NASA and ISRO also signed it, ended up signing Amethyst Pact, by which we the two countries were to collaborate on the manned lunar mission and intergalactic planetary missions. And then we also had the marquee deal, which was a highlight of the visit. And that was about a GE F414 engine to HAL, which were to be used for Tejas Mark II fighter jet of India. And apparently, as per the news reports, Americans are transferring 80% of the technology in the jet engines provided by GE, which includes repair for turbine, compression disc and blades, coating and machines of crystal turbine blades, machining and coating of hot end parts, complete tech transfer for BLISC machining, machining and coating of the hot end parts, and metal machining of the powder metallurgy, polymer matrix complex, and laser drilling for combustion, boring shaft, and the bottle boring of shaft. So this, all these parts were, integral to, this technology transfer deal, which is one of its kind after World War II, as my friend Himja highlighted. So, and apparently we've also agreed to purchase 31 MQ-9 drones, armed Predator ones, right? And this will be used by Air Force, Navy, and your Air Force, Navy, and Army. So now the thing is, apparently we also signed, Micron Technology is setting up a silicon semiconductor testing plant in Gujarat. So these were the broad summary of deals, but I would like to highlight two or three specific things. One, there is a transfer of technology to HAL, which is very critical because India can then export along with American, agreements or whatever we have understanding, Tejas Mark II to other countries which are, in an anti-China alliance or an anti-China bloc, and sort of a new military industrial complex.
Basically, we are looking at, so this is all going towards creating our military industrial complex. And Navroop, all the agreements that you listed out, right? Literally year after year, from your Lemoa to your Concasa to the satellite data, the encrypted data sharing, so on and so forth. If one looks at that in context, it seems like a very, very natural culmination, because this was literally step by step. And who knows? In fact, the last significant deal we signed was, I think, round about 20. Had the pandemic not happened, this probably would have happened a lot earlier. Don't you think?
Yes, probably. And I guess the war in Ukraine also, what happened, also spurred a lot many changes. And, on the 5th of June, what agreements were signed in 2023, which I talked about. The biggest one, which are, the highlight one are, logistic sharing and repair and maintenance of US and Quad allies. Now, this is exactly the role what we played, you remember, in World War One and World War Two.
I was just about to say that. It's like full circle. Life is coming a full circle.
Yes, exactly. And the second part, that US will integrate Indian defense industry and aerospace into supply chain of US defense and aerospace industry. And now, 7 agreements we have signed, 2 more are to be signed, which will make even Indian corporate defense firms, private corporates, to become part of the defense military industrial complex with US, and they can also become future contractors into it.
So we are going to have our own Lockheed Martin, you mean?
Yeah, not exactly locking, but maybe miniature ones. Maybe miniature ones. Good one. Good one.
Okay. So, yeah. So I mean, it seems like as if we are becoming a factory of sorts for the American corporates or the American military industrial complex, right? Like they don't. I mean, though they have the capacity, but unfortunately, the manufacturing in USA has not picked up. As you know, they sort of believed, but now India, by signing these agreements, kind of sort of helping them to build weapons for them, armaments for them, when they need it during critical.
If I can slightly give a correction here, when we say factory, the general meaning is understood to be something of an assembly line setup. An assembly line setup will not help us create our own MIC. But it's only because of the TOT and the other agreements that okay, they may be doing the manufacturing here. But the question is that if we are just doing assembly, that manufacturing beyond, adding to our revenue and giving services is not giving any further value. Okay. The difference being this time that with this manufacturing, we are in a position to create our own MIC, especially when, as Navroop said, that when the corporates get to join, it becomes even more significant because then you are looking at a full-blown MIC creation possibility. I mean, of course, we did begin the process indigenously, but we need a boost. And I think this is the boost. This is what's going to make it bigger, faster.
Correct. And I like to add, one more facet to it. So, there's been a lot of debate and topic, are we becoming a vassal state or something like that? So your listeners must, get this perspective very clear that, unlike Japan, unlike South Korea, none of them are recognized nuclear power or have a nuclear program. They require US nuclear umbrella against a foreign enemy or a foreign adversary. So India, unfortunately, has its own nuclear program, its own nuclear deterrent, its own missile program, its own capability to produce frigates and submarines, even non-nuclear submarines, right? Even to produce small artillery and tanks. So that makes it India, India by itself is also a military power, manufacturing military power. This is only further going to add into our technology, give a sharpening edge to our military, as well as, we will end up having a robust military industrial complex years down the lane. So we are not technically a vassal or something like that. It's a partnership, actually, basically.
Got it. I mean,
I think it'll unleash the power of what we already have. It's a bit like how today Israel is becoming a force to be reckoned with, right? It's competing with all its Western counterparts and coming out on top. Israel is doing very, very well.
Right, absolutely. Like it is competing with NASA, it is competing with SpaceX itself, when it comes to moving up satellites in the space. Interesting. So, I mean, thank you for that perspective that, many of the people must be thinking that we have sort of become a vassal to USA, but I think that perspective helps. And we being a nuclear power, that gives us enough leverage also. And again, it will depend in future upon the what kind of future political scenario will be in India, the post Modi world, what it will be. Again, that will be also displaying. But the leadership.
There's another point. When people use words like vassal state and things like that, the whole thing is that you also have to have a reality check, right? I mean, what is the size of India? What is the size of China? What is the size of the US? If you want to compete, I mean, let's ask the first important question. Let's be honest and say, are we in a position to really compete? Can we compete?
Right.
So when you need help, you have to take all the help you can get. The only thing you can do is that fortunately, that we are poised at a time of a very interesting global reset, where it means that we are in a position to lay down stronger cards than what we could have done maybe 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So all we can do is actually lay down our cards to the best of our ability, negotiate with strength as much as we can, have faith in our leadership, which we seem to have a good one at the moment, and you know, and hope that things will go the way they should be going.
Agreed, agreed. Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, like going further to our discussion. So, you know, the grand Russian roulette, you know, which is being played in Russia currently. So, you know, first two Navroops, I know you have written very detailed, amazing, you know, article in your blog. So, you know, how do you see the India-Russia relationship going forward in the context of this whole Wagner rebellion, which has happened in Russia and which was kind of, you know, suddenly it was like within 24 hours, it was kind of, you know, assault. So how do you see what's happening in Russia, and vis-a-vis that, what sort of decisions Indians are taking when it comes to our relationship with Russia, with other allied states of Russia, basically?
Yeah. So thing is, I'll first discuss about the Wagner rebellion, because that is something, you know, most of the Indians do not know, you know, what is happening. Unfortunately, the Kremlin walls are so huge that it's very difficult to peep inside what is happening. So you only have to gather information from outside and join the dots, right? So the thing is that Wagner chief, Yevgeny Prigozhin, had, you know, issues with Russian Defense Ministry for long. Actually, if you actually ask, just a second, I'll just open it up. Just a second.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Just a second. Okay. Yeah.
Kremlin Palace politics.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So, see what happened. Prigozhin had shared a detail. It started in 2018. This was in Shammam area of Syria where it started. The source of this was happened, you know, conflict between Shoigu, who is the defense minister of Russia, and Gerasimov, who is the chief of staff of the Russian army. And Gerasimov is the same man who controls the nuclear keys along with Vladimir Putin. You know, he is the one who carries the briefcase. And, you know, in case the prime minister, the president decides to launch a nuclear strike, it is the chief of staff which decides to carry out the execution of it. So the events happen in Deryzor, as Prigozhin spoke about. Prigozhin did not explain why it happened the last minute. But the offensive of the Wagner PMC was called out to seize the oil fields over there. The General Chief of Staff of Strategic Expediency of capturing ISIS stronghold in Conoco plant in the interest of control of oil fields of Al-Omar, the main Syrian oil field, which would allow destroying the ISIS and preventing the advance of Kurdish formations under the American control. The idea looked really impeccable. But the problem is, on February 7th, it became known that this plan was a gamble by Wagner PMC, that is a private military contractor, aimed at gaining access in the oil field. And Prigozhin, you know, sought permission from Shoigu, the Ministry of Defense, and Gerasimov to, you know, to go ahead and capture this oil field and take away a lot of, you know, the money making power from below ISIS and deal a very big blow to even American sponsored rebels in Syria. But somehow these two, you know, Shoigu and these people, they did not give the go ahead to do it. And it is why the Wagner PMC, you know, the Wagner chief, you know, felt frustrated. You know, what is this? You know, like, you know, you are not allowing me to carry out an operation which is very critical to Russian interest and probably against America. Because we must also understand that America in the northeast of Syria already has bases along with Turkey, okay, is operating there, has its own militias. So there is probably some kind of a backroom understanding between the global powers in Syria that what is their respective domain and no one is going to infringe upon it. So that was the start. That was a spark which started. Then you came down to Ukraine, what was happening in Ukraine. See, in the Ukraine conflict, the Russian regulars were constantly getting targeted by the NATO-sponsored Ukraine and their mercenaries, whoever, you know, the kind of armory was provided. But what happened was, Prigozhin recently, in early the late May of 2023, laughed off at a statement of Russian MOD saying, "Oh no, 1,500 Ukrainian troops have been killed," and he said, "This is a joke. These were actually his words, not my words, right?"
Yeah, yeah.
And then he said these were science fiction. And Wagner took 8 months to take back Bakhmut, which was the first victory after Russia lost Kherson to the Ukrainian forces. But then Prigozhin, because he became a social media hero, he was putting videos on Telegram and everything. And unfortunately, the Kremlin is a very isolated place. You don't get to know what much is happening outside your territory. Right, when you build up high walls, the biggest problem is that you yourself do not get to see outside what is happening. this guy became a real popular icon in Russia. He became a cult figure virtually, the Wagner chief. So on 23rd June 2023, that was a week 10 days back, on the night. The Prigozhin, when Prime Minister Modi was in the White House doing his conference with President Biden, on the very few hours later, Prigozhin declares on social media that Russian Defense Forces have targeted our camp and they have killed our Wagner forces, and that is when he said, "I'm going to march on Moscow." The next day morning, the events were crazy. We all saw on TV, with column of tanks, even S-400 system, and a convoy of 400. He kept on marching all towards Moscow, right?
Correct.
And the most beautiful part is there was no obstruction given to him. He kept on marching as if it's an expressway, and he's going out for a joyride, and Russian army is not present at all. And then he says, "Okay, I want to remove the Russian defense leadership, gunning for Shoigu and your Geremesov." And then later, when the president did not respond, he said, "Okay, and now I'm going to go after the president as well." Mm-hmm. But by the evening, things took a very drastic turn. By the evening, suddenly there's an announcement that Belarusian President Lukashenko has intervened, right? Broken a ceasefire between the Russian government and the Wagner chief, where they decided that Wagner chief and the Belarusian and its militias will be excommunicated to Belarus in case they want to go. There's an amnesty which Putin decided to give despite coming on TV and saying, "Oh, I'll prosecute you, traitor, treason," and all this stuff happened. So, and the other part was, he said, okay, and all the cases would be withdrawn. But then we find that one of the Russian generals was also involved, Surkovin or something like that, who is now under detention. So now this points to something. I cannot believe myself, that Wagner can run all across to Moscow without any internal help, because Russia's elite is very, the clans inside Russia are, actually, like in China, you have the princelings of Xi, then you have Shanghai oligarchy and the peasants of the PLA. These are the three parts of the CCP, right?
Correct.
Similarly, in Kremlin, you have various sections. You have the Yeltsin loyalists, the oligarchs, you have the communists, the liberal party, the FSB, the Petersburg politician, who bled into the power structure of the Kremlin. Then the Petersburger are actually called Siboliki, S-I-V-O-L-I-K-I. Now that is actually where Vladimir Putin and Dmitry Medvedev come from. And the Moscow Whites were the one from, the Yeltsin clique, which used to rule. So now the Petersburgers are in total control of the Russian elite. So these are these clans which have been built up. I've detailed in my blog. But then one, you have to understand one thing. Wagner will not be dismantled for a reason, because Wagner controls significant amount of influence for Russia's military operations in Africa. Now, Africa, you have a lot of resource-rich countries in which you have, Central African Republic, where they go for gold, or they go to Libya for oil field. They work in Sudan. They work in Madagascar. They work in Mozambique. So, Russian mercenaries are probably the largest paramilitary militia firm on the planet And now what is going to happen is, what we have heard, that Vladimir Putin wanted to make the Wagner come under Russian MOD. Unfortunately, the Wagner chief had grown too big for his boots, and he was saying, oh no, I don't want to be, governed, because the lure, the riches and the fame which he got, probably that took to him. And he said, no, you have to sign the contract with the Russian Ministry of Defense. You come under the Defense Ministry. He said, no.
You have to be integrated and accountable, basically.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So there is accountability of what is going on over here, right? So this was a factional rivalry come. And probably, I will not, dismiss in foreign hand, probably the CIA or someone doing something. And that, that is something which will probably come out, months or years down the lane. If the Pentagon was really, or the Langley was really, nudging one of the Kremlin clans inside the Kremlin to allow this rebellion to continue, allow the...
Correct. So officially, America has completely denied any involvement. They have gone on record to say that. Yeah.
See, the beauty about the power play inside the Kremlin is you will never know, what is exactly happened inside.
Correct. So, recently there was this news where, one of the important generals of Putin was fired and has been detained. So, was he a fall guy when Prigozhin was actually kind of blaming the two, the Shoghi and that other guy, he was kept blaming. Right. So I think one guy, I think it was the, I'm really bad with the
Russian names. I know that.
Russian names are
very confusing. So what do you think, sir? Was he a fall guy or Putin just to placate, the Wagner?
I'll tell you, the Wagner chief is not an idiot to virtually, march on to Moscow on his own and face no resistance, unless someone from inside Russia's military industrial leadership, and even inside the Kremlin was saying, giving a nudge, beta ja, go ahead, do it. Right? Like someone
would have to be someone very, very significant.
Yes, very.
The consequences in Russia of committing treason are not going to jail.
It's either you drink a tea with a drop of a polonium or you fall from a window. So all that kind of stuff happens.
Interesting things happen to those that go against Vladimir Putin in Russia.
So which is why, this palace intrigue, which is why Vladimir Putin will have to probably he will dig it out in due course of time, which was the faction which was striking for him. So
he probably already knew, he just wanted to crush them out, and he probably wanted a legitimate reason to go after them. Knowing and having proof are two different things. With this, he was able to crush them out. And now, the Kremlin will do what it does best, purge.
Obviously, that's the traditional modus of operandi or the, SOP of the Kremlin, Like you go for, mass scale culling, they will shift here and there, the power centers will shift, and I believe there will be a lot of changes coming in the Russian military setup. Even inside the Kremlin, there'll be a shakeup, because, Vladimir Putin, knowing his nature, he'll be a bit paranoid, who is the one around me? Because if you remember, even in August last year, and especially February, when the invasion began, The American military was shouting 1 month in advance, अरे invasion होने वाला है, 15 दिन में हो रहा है, 10 दिन में हो रहा है, अगले एक हफ्ते में हो रहा है. So that means someone from inside was leaking those informations out. It cannot be a coincidence, no? That your enemy knows your precise plan. What are you going to do?
Correct. And you know, like I usually listen to this guy called Peter Zahan. He has his channel on YouTube now. He gives a monologue for like 8 or 10 minutes. So whenever he discusses things about Russia, he always says this. American deep state, or you can, the CIA is very well entrenched into the Russian system. They know the Russian system in and out, and their guys are there inside the system. So I think you are probably right that, I mean, the inside system in itself is compromised of Russia. And that's the reason why USA was able to kind of, get to know that, the invasion is going to happen. And also the way the war is going on for Russia, Mr. Putin wanted to take Kyiv in 3 days, and now it is, more than 400 days now, and no Kyiv has been taken. Only a couple of key cities in the eastern Ukraine has been taken, but again they are facing the difficulty, and now there is a talk of Ukraine counteroffensive, which is going to start, and I think which has started. So, ma'am, in this context, I would like to have your views as to, things which are happening in Russia and with Vladimir Putin, can you open about what sort of geopolitical upheaval, it will have on the world, on the Russian relationship, or vice versa of other countries with Russia?
You mean like Russian relationship with India or Russian relationship with other countries?
With other countries, including India, the whole geopolitical effect of it as to what is happening in Russia. Now, so you're on mute, actually.
Okay. So the thing is that the Russian way of doing business, as far as the foreign policy is concerned, has been changing in the last few years. Russia has, it has tried to basically develop a closer relationship with China. Again, I don't believe that this is honestly their choice, but more to do with hard realities because of what has happened. Since the last few years, they've been bleeding, they've been facing sanctions, and Russia remains a resource-rich country. That's how they do business. Their way of doing business can never be compared to the way the Americans conduct business, because just like Russia, just like China, their businesses are completely state-owned. Even if something is private, it's never completely private. There's always a state backing that, that works at the, at the back end. So because of this, they don't really have a choice but to, since America is the one that has been sanctioning them, has got them out of the SWIFT system, they are bleeding in so many ways. A Chinese partnership is inevitable, even though they know that the Chinese are, they are attacking them. They are systematically, occupying their Far East, Siberia, and so on and so forth, which is why Russia even attempted to, get some sort of a compromise with Japan, with whom they face another territorial issue. They are looking at compromising and things like that. So for a country that always had a very hard stand on things, they are trying, but there is only so much that they can do. And now, as far as India is concerned, a lot of people say that, a lot of analysts that actually share a lot of love for Russia, share a lot of loyalty for Russia,
right? Especially loyalty, that's the correct word.
Yeah, saying that, Russia came to our aid in, 1970, 1971. Yes, of course it did. There is no denying that. But then there is also no denying the Mitrokhin archive. So, like I said, it's foreign policy. Each country is in it for itself. So, yes, the Russians helped us, but after that, they also managed to get a very attractive foothold in the country, which they have, I would not like to use the word exploited, because a country can only exploit you if you allow it. Here, I think, they basically achieved a decent amount of penetration, and we were one of the largest arms buyers. They succeeded, we succeeded, but we also needed the weapons. So we should hardly, you know, turn around and say, okay, you know, I mean, they did this to us. No, you know, they didn't do anything to us. But yes, you know, we enjoyed a good relationship. But let's be very, very honest. Russians have walked away from us first.
Correct. Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So the thing is, I mean, and again, you know, this marriage, this marriage of convenience between Russia and China, and Russia remains a very, very resource-rich country. You know, they have their gold reserves within the country. Despite all the sanctions, despite all the hardships, they have survived. I would not like to say they have tried, because that's not exactly true. But, you know, but they have survived. The Russians are very, very tough people. I think if the Western world had to go through these kind of sanctions or these kind of hardships, they would have melted, you know, a long time back. So, yes, let's give Russia the credit where it's due. Now, as far as, because Russia remains a resource-rich country with, you know, with decent leadership, we have predicted this in our book, that we do expect Russia at some point to deviate from its natural course up until the time, I mean, currently it's just biding its time. It's also building its strength, because, you know, it has been leading. So it needs to do what it needs to do. But as far as we are concerned, we also need to do what we need to do. So currently, you know, we are pursuing our relationship with the United States for our strategic interest. However, it is also in our interest that Russia remains strong. We don't want a Russia that becomes completely dependent on China ever. That would be very, very bad for us. And we would also want a Russia that for us can work as a balancer of sorts. Because if America is looking at India being a balancer as far as China is concerned, who would India be looking at as a balancer? There are only two other geographies that are possible. One is the Middle East. The Middle East is resource rich, but the Middle East is very, very different compared to Russia. So Russia would be the natural, you know, would be the natural source because of, you know, its natural wealth, also, you know, existing history that we have and so on and so forth. So, which is why, you know, India is not going to move away, because even Dr. Jaishankar has been very, very clear. He has always said India is going to pursue a strategy of multipolarity, which means India is going to end up having relations with all countries. You know, even as far as our weapon purchases are concerned, we are not going to be buying just from the US. You know, we'll end up buying something from France. We'll end up buying something from other countries. You know, we're also doing this for Russia. I mean, even for Russia, when they were bleeding last year because of sanctions, with the G7 deciding to impose, you know, a price ceiling on them, India was the one that has been buying. I mean, India is the largest buyer of Russian oil today. All thanks to a certain creativity which has been created by the EU charter, which is allowing us to simply, you know, import, refine, and then sell. I mean, it is no secret that we are exporting this oil back to the US and UK, because US has emptied out as SPR. So that's okay. You know, we are just simply playing the rule. So we are basically making everyone happy. And that's good. That's the policy we need to pursue, that we need to be on good terms with everybody. Because there is also another very, very classic saying, that being a friend of the United States is fatal. Being an enemy is bad, but being a friend is fatal.
Right.
Yeah, so, I like to add on this. Yeah. You know, also to add to what my friend Himja said, you know, we have so many dependencies on Russia. It is not only, you know, like we have Sukhoi systems, our Air Force, a big warhorse of our Air Force is still dependent upon it, right?
Yeah.
Our nuclear submarine lease from Russia. Also, we have the tanks, T-72 tanks, which are also of the Russian origin. We have our military transport jets, IL-76 and others, which are also part of the Russian origin. Plus, we also have, you know, a huge dependency on fertilizers, which Russia is one of the largest producers of potash and urea and fertilizers in the world, and wheat as well. So we must always remember, imagine if Russia had sanctioned India or not given India, and India sided with the West, given into the West's demands, and we had not got those fertilizers free, you know, at cheap rates, our food inflation would have gone through the roof. And literally, that would have meant that would have been, and you know, not buying Russian cheap oil and not getting good for, you know, timely supply of regular constant supply of cheap fertilizers from Russia would have destroyed our food security, our energy security. So that exactly. So that was the most critical part, which I think your listeners must always remember.
For populous countries like India and China, food inflation is a small component. Food security is the major part.
Exactly.
Because feeding a billion plus people becomes, you know, that is something that can actually be used as a form of weaponization.
Economic warfare.
Which is why we know that since China has only about 20% arable land in their country, they have taken tracts and tracts of land, land parcels in Africa. Just so they are able to feed their people. Food security is very, very important because it is the surest and the quickest way to ignite a civil war.
Agreed, agreed. I totally agree with that. Also, but, you know, looking at things as they are currently, you know, when we see Russia as Russia, where do you think Russia is sort of moving? Like, everyone knows that there is kind of a bonhomie with China currently. But do you think it will become permanent of sorts, or is this just a temporary arrangement till the Ukraine war, you know, may go on, and after that, you know, there may be a recalibration of sorts?
Can I give a cheeky answer? We've given the answer to this in the book.
No, don't worry. I'll post the link.
That's fine. Jokes apart. Yeah. You know. The Chinese learned from the Russians, just the way the Americans learned from the British. If you look at the history of the Cold War, the best spies were from Britain, and the best counter spies were also from the FSB, KGB. So China has learned from Russia. And Russia is, you know, I mean, I have a lot of respect for the way their country conducts themselves. We are not debating systems here, because, you know, they have their model of governance. We have our model of governance. So, you know, we are not passing a value judgment, but we are simply talking about the way they have conducted. You know, at the height of the Cold War, Russia controlled and influenced the highest amount of territory globally. To be able to manage that is not a small feat.
Agreed.
It's not a small feat. I mean, of course, it's going to have its imperfections. No system is perfect. But when you see that, I would not write off Russia so easily. Like I said, you know, that according to me, and I think, you know, Navroop will also agree, because this is something we have written in the book, that this is a temporary marriage. It's a marriage of convenience. Just the way China has been biding its time, Russia is biding its time. Things have not been working in its favor. Now, some things are working in their favor. Things are slightly better than what they were before. I fully expect that a country that is so resource rich and, you know, seasoned would not go down so easily. Mm. And at some point, yes, they will emerge as the joker in the pack.
100%. I agree to that assessment because we have explained this in length in our book. In length.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Hi. This was a first part of our conversation focusing on USA-India relationship and on events in Russia. We'll be back with the second part next week, which focuses on China and Pakistan axis. Thank you and Namaste.